Today's podcast is titled Catholic New Testament Research and the Significance of the Encyclical Divino Afflante Spiritu and Vatican II. Here's the Australian Catholic Historical Society's President, Dr. John Carmody, to introduce the speaker, Dr. Bruce Kay.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the 17th of October meeting of the Australian Catholic Historical Society, which is our second Zoom session. And today we're privileged to have Dr. Bruce Kay as the speaker. He'll be talking on Catholic New Testament research and the significance of the encyclical Divino Afflante Spiritu and Vatican II. But before introducing him, I must pass on some sad news. Yesterday's edition of the Sydney Morning Herald, as some of you know, contained notices of the deaths of two of our diligent members, Brother Stanislaus Cusack and Mr. Brian McAteer. In the early years of my presidency, Stan was a regular attendee at our meetings, and so was Brian, a distinguished predecessor with an enduring commitment as a councillor, president, and member of the society. His detailed knowledge of Australian Catholic history and of our secular politics was enormous, and if I may say so, was probably unrivalled. Requiescant in pace. So now I'd like to move on to introduce today's speaker. Dr. Bruce Kay is one of Australian Anglicanism's eminent theologians and one of Australia's finest historians of religion. His academic record is glittering. He is a graduate of the universities of Sydney, London, and Basel in Switzerland, and has taught at the University of Durham in the United Kingdom and at the University of New South Wales. He was formerly General Secretary of the Anglican Church in Australia and was Master of New College at the University of New South Wales, which was where I met him. He has written extensively on Anglican history and theology, but his intellectual interests are far wider and more ecumenical than that. Indeed, this is his second address to ACCHS. When he suggested today's important topic, I confess that I had absolutely no knowledge of the papal encyclical, which is at the heart of it. We Christian Brothers schoolboys in Brisbane tended to give little attention to such recherche documents as encyclicals. Brisbane was and is a long way from Rome. Subsequently, while reading the recent Cambridge Companion to Vatican II, I have encountered several references to it, in particular to the work of the Dominican Marie-Joseph Lagrange, who, in the words of the Irish scholar Gabriel Flynn in that book, is, quote, credited most in the advancement of biblical scholarship and in the seismic shift, I love that phrase, in the seismic shift in the official Catholic attitude towards critical study of the Bible, thus paving the way for Pius XII's encyclical Divino Afflante Spiritu. In fact, it may not be going too far to say that the existence of the renowned Jerusalem Bible would be unthinkable without that encyclical. Today, Dr. Kay will educate us far more deeply about its background and its fruits. He tells me that some of the material of today's paper draws upon research which he did in the old German city of Freiburg im Breisgau, in the far west of the modern state of Baden-Württemberg, whilst he was a recipient of a fellowship of the German Academic Exchange Service, the renowned Deutscher Akademischer Austauschdienst, the DAAD. That is one thing that we share, but I must admit that my own introduction to Freiburg was far less scholarly and worthy. In the very hot summer of 1977, on the way back to Munich from the International Physiological Congress in Paris, we stopped in Freiburg, and in a cafe across the Platz from the Cathedral of Our Beloved Lady, with its three organs, three famous organs, two colleagues and I each devoured a large bowl of delicious ice cream. I dare say that Dr. Kay's sojourn there was far less sybaritic. Ladies and gentlemen, it is with great pleasure and gratitude that I introduce Dr. Bruce Kay to address us and inform us today. Thanks, Bruce.
Thank you, Jack, for the introduction. I vaguely recognise parts of it. I think it's kind of you to invite me back a second time, and I feel a little bit cheeky to come to you this time speaking about something to do with the Roman Catholic Church. And I hope I might learn a little more about what I've done in relation to biblical New Testament scholarship in the Catholic Church. I want to focus on the middle of the 20th century. It seems to me this is a crucial period in the development of Christianity in the Western world, and particularly in New Testament scholarship. It's not often noted how significant were the changes that took place in the middle of the 20th century in New Testament scholarship. And it happened in two different ways in the Roman Catholic Church and in the Protestant Church. And this is, in a sense, this paper is part one of a part two of a two-part effort. And I'll be looking at the Protestant experience of the middle of the 20th century and the changes that took place there sometime later, if I survive. But the Catholic situation is remarkable in many, many ways. I first read Divino Affante Spiritu back in the 1950s as a student in a Protestant seminary, which is probably something. And it always struck me as being an extraordinarily important document. The middle of the 20th century is marked culturally, of course, by what we know as the 1960s or the long 1960s and the Cultural Revolution and intellectual changes that took place there. And that provides a backdrop to the kind of material that I want to talk about today. I think you have a paper circulated to you. I don't plan to read it. I plan to speak to it. And if I don't make sense, you can go back and read the paper later. I do that particularly because one section of the paper has got a lot of detail in it, which I don't think is susceptible to Zoom treatment. I'm interested in that cultural change period in the 50s and 60s and early 70s as they apply to institutions. And as they apply, particularly, I'll come to the institutionality of the Roman Catholic Church. You will remember that the outbreak of student revolutions in the 1960s in France and Germany and Switzerland. I won't say I participated in them, but I was there in Switzerland at the time, and it was, I'd have to say, quite exciting. But the two things that I note about that period in this regard is that it had a kind of individualistic, kind of romantic style spirit to it, but also a quite striking anti-institutionalism. Institutions, in a sense, were the tribunes of the past, and in that respect, they carried the values and assumptions of the past against which the students wanted to contest very strongly. And I therefore want to come at this question with that in the background. It's not the only background, but it is an important background. Let me read a little bit of what I've got in my text. The question of Hugh MacLeod, a very famous English social historian, wrote that the 1960s period was probably as significant in Western civilization as the Reformation. It's a big claim. He's a very famous and distinguished historian, and he nominates a number of things that are important. A loss of connection with the previous generation of Christians, the opportunity for more options of religious commitment in the Western societies, and a sense of society as no longer being Christian. There's a kind of public phasing of the Christendom assumptions. So what I want to look at here is that the Protestant and Catholic churches were affected by this change in different ways. Different institutions were challenged in each of the churches, though in each case, the underlying issue was the legitimating authority accepted within the church. The long 1960s focused on authority and how the church shaped its understanding of the faith. For Catholics, that pointed most specifically, to its central clerical institutions and ultimately the magisterium. The focus for Protestants was scripture and the institution of the canon. These are the focal points on which this cultural change was directed. But some prehistory, first of all, about the Catholic situation. Being a more coherent institutional church, the Catholic Church experienced the long 1960s was shaped by its own structure and history. Furthermore, there was a longer institutional engagement in the Catholic Church with the issue of authority in the context of a changing host culture, not quite as much, in Protestantism. That theme came clearly to the fore in the encounter with the historical critical method in the middle of the 20th century. Two great papal encyclicals provide the essential framework for the confluence that emerged in relation to scripture in the middle of the 20th century. Providentissimus Dei from Pope Leo, published in the 18th of November 1893, and 50 years later, Divina Afflante Spiritu from Pope Pius XII, published on the 30th of September 1943. Pius presented his encyclical as a celebration of Providentissimus and a continuation of the movement reflected in that earlier document. Though a great deal, of course, had happened in Europe between 1893 and 1943. Leo began by affirming the great dignity of Scripture, and he wished to see more involved in the study of Scripture. At the same time, he wished also to see more done in engaging with contemporary cultural changes. First of all, looking back to Pope Leo, he says in his encyclical, those in the history of the Church known for their piety and faith were also known for their engagement with Scripture. Attention was given to the production of text, such as the Vulgate and the Septuagint, following Vatican I. Elsewhere, from that time downwards, he says, the labour and solicitude of Catholics has never been wanting, for as time went on, eminent scholars have carried on biblical study with success and have defended Holy Scripture against rationalism with the same weapons of philosophy and kindred sciences with which it had been attacked. Professors of theology, most of all, that they may understand that God has delivered the Holy Scriptures to the Church and that in reading and making use of his word, they must follow the Church as their guide and their teacher. That's a very important theme that occurs again in Divino Afflante Spiritu. But by this most wise decree, he says, the Church by no means prevents or restrains the pursuit of biblical science, but rather protects it from error and largely assists its real progress. There's a balance there which he's pointing to, which I think is quite important in understanding the way in which New Testament developed in the middle of the century. Nonetheless, he argues that all interpretation is foolish and false, which either makes the sacred scriptures disagree with one another, that's the inerrancy point, or is opposed to the doctrine of the Church. While this encyclical encourages an historical research, the Church remains the final source of truth and the arbiter of the correct interpretation of Scripture. For the New Testament professor, the Scriptures are internally consistent. Each part of Scripture shares the authority of the whole. The theologian works in the service of the Church and under the authority of the magisterium. There's a great deal here to encourage New Testament professors. Language is a key question to be rightly pursued, implying the end of the singular authority of the Vulgate. The investigation of language and context are positively encouraged. There is more movement and openness offered to the professors, and there is a strong encouragement for their work. This is, in many ways, opening the door to what Pope Pius would later say. Pope Pius's encyclical in 1943 opens by asserting, this heaven-sent treasure Holy Church considers as the most precious source of doctrine and faith and morals, Scripture he's talking about. He then looks back on previous contributions to an evolving pattern of responses to changing cultural environments and the place of Scripture in the life of the Church. In my reading of this encyclical, this is one of the most important elements in this encyclical. It is reaffirmed in section 10. We firmly hope that in the future, reverence for, as well as the use and knowledge of the sacred scriptures, will everywhere more and more increase for the good of souls, provided the methods of biblical study laid down by Leo XIII explained more clearly and perfectly by his successors, and by us confirmed and amplified, which indeed is the only safe and proven experience, be more firmly, eagerly, and faithfully accepted by all, regardless of the difficulties which, as in all human affairs, so in this most excellent work, will never be wanting. It's a wonderfully balanced paragraph, which is holding together a number of important points. He goes on, we also, by this encyclical letter, desire to ensure that the work may not only proceed without interruption, but so daily be more fruitful. And to that end, we are especially intent on pointing out to all what yet remains to be done, with what spirit the Catholic exegete should undertake at the present day so great and noble a work, and to give new incentive and fresh courage to the labours of those who toil so strenuously in the vineyard of the Lord. These are very strong words of encouragement to New Testament professors, biblical scholars. The purpose of these endeavours was that the mind of the author of the scriptural texts may be made abundantly clear. It's a very striking phrase in the middle of the encyclical, the mind of the author. This statement of the purpose opens up the more radical import of the encyclical. It prefigures an historical question of historical documents using appropriate tools of historiography. Let the interpreter, he says, then, with all care and without neglecting any light derived from recent research, endeavour to determine the peculiar character and circumstances of the sacred writer, the age in which he lived, the sources written or oral to which he had recourse, and the forms of expression he employed. It's a really neat summary of the kind of contextualizing stream that is always present in New Testament research. He quotes St. Athanasius, here, as indeed is expedient in all other passages of Scripture, it should be noted, this is Athanasius, on what occasion the Apostle spoke, we should carefully and faithfully observe to whom and why he wrote, lest being ignorant of these points or confounding one with another, we miss the real meaning of the author. If you put that into the 20th century, it sounds very modern, but actually Athanasius was addressing the Arians. And the issue he was addressing was not the date, but the history of salvation context in which the author was writing and to whom he was writing. So it was whether he was writing in the hope of Christ or looking back to the incarnation. But it's a theological point which carries with it a question about the way in which history of salvation relates to history more broadly conceived. The encyclical goes on, this state of things is no reason why the Catholic commentator, inspired by an active and ardent love of his subject and sincerely devoted to Holy Mother Church, should in any way be deterred from grappling again and again with these difficult problems, hitherto unsolved, not only that he may refute the objections of the adversaries, but also may attempt to find a satisfactory solution which will be in full accord with the doctrine of the Church, in particular with the traditional teaching regarding the inerrancy of sacred scripture, and which will at the same time satisfy the indubitable conclusions of profane sciences. Again, a balanced statement of the two issues. Having expounded and recommended those things which are required for adaptation of scripture studies to the necessities of the day, it remains, he says, venerable brethren and beloved sons, mainly the New Testament scholars he's talking about, or biblical scholars, that to biblical scholars who are devoted sons of the Church and follow faithfully her teaching and direction, we address our paternal affection, not only our congratulations that they have been chosen and called to so sublime an office, but also our encouragement to continue with ever renewed vigour and with all zeal and care the work so happily begun. That kind of green lighting to biblical scholars is really terrifically important when it comes right in the middle of the 20th century. The positive encouragement of this text and the clear invitation to go further became an important part of the dynamic that propelled German New Testament scholarship to such extraordinary and creative activities in the long 1960s. And that means not just German New Testament scholarship generally, but Roman Catholic scholars. So what happened? Did the German Roman Catholic scholars, who were the predominant German-speaking scholars, who were a very strong part of the tradition of biblical studies, how did they react? What happened? In the long 1960s, Germany was still divided, with the old Luther lands generally in the Democratic Republic from the end of the war. The Federal Republic was, or had been, mainly Roman Catholic. Generally in this period, there were separate Protestant and Catholic faculties in German universities. Professors were appointed by the relevant church or in liaison with the church and the university. There was a quite remarkable explosion of New Testament scholarship in German Roman Catholic faculties. More than that, it is quite extraordinary. Following the near destruction of German infrastructure in the war, at the Potsdam Conference in 1945, the Allies agreed to force Germany into a pastoral economy, and factories were dismantled and German prisoners were used as forced labour by all the Allies. All the Allies aggressively harvested technical and scientific intellectual property as a kind of intellectual reparations. There were major forced population displacements in which something like 2 million people died. The Allies changed their policy as the Cold War began. The Marshall Plan started in 1947. The Federal Republic of Germany was created in 1949, 4 years after the end of the war, and military occupation ended in 1959 when West Germany joined NATO. It is in that context that an extraordinary flourishing of German New Testament research took place. If you have my paper, the appendix gives you a lot of details, which I won't go into, but it's worth just getting an idea of the astonishing flourishing of scholarship and publishing and research work that went on in the period up until roughly the 74, mid-70s. I mentioned just a few things. Journals and monograph series. Journals and monographs generally are where new research is published in the German system and generally in New Testament scholarship. There are new journals containing material not only of articles but of reports of monographs that were published in this period. Biblical essays, I guess you'd call it, contain a great deal of material in that regard. Dissertation numbers multiplied dramatically across the universities. They went from very small numbers to very high numbers. And people were doing PhDs in German Catholic faculties on a wide range of topics: Jesus, the Gospels, resurrection. And there were a number of very notable theses done on ecclesiology or church order in the New Testament material and its relationship to later developments. There are a number of people who stood out as great contributors to this. So let's just comment that in the German system, and it's generally true elsewhere, generally speaking, the subject of a dissertation would be guided very strongly by the professor. Candidates would approach a professor to work with a professor, and then they talk about what the dissertation might be about. And generally speaking, the professor had a strong influence on what was done. That meant that the kind of dissertation research which was being done in these German, when I say German, German-speaking, that's to say Germany and Austria, Vienna, a big player in this, was very largely influenced by what the professors were interested in doing. And having said that, then, it's clear that while there were fundamental theological issues that were being addressed by these dissertations, there was quite a lot of work being done on those subjects which bore on the relationship of the New Testament to the ecclesial life of the church. The main group of PhD theses done in this period treated church and office, interpretation and resurrection, which, and it's interesting to me that there weren't that many people doing things on topics like justification. Mind you, there weren't that many Protestants doing research on that subject either at that time. So if you, I invite you to look at that list. I don't want to go through them. They're large numbers and a lot of statistics in them. But my point is that in the period from after the war to 74, maybe, you see just an extraordinary explosion of Roman Catholic New Testament research. And I think that has to do with, very much to do with the institutional tradition that lay behind Catholic biblical studies up until this period. And the two encyclicals to which I have referred, I think, were extremely important in encouraging that kind of growth of New Testament research. Actual physical facilities in Germany in the immediate post-war years were not very great, but people nonetheless found ways of doing PhDs, and universities found ways of promoting and advancing an immense amount of New Testament research. There are a number of very important people who led this. Anton Wörtler, who was a professor at Freiburg, was the professor there when I spent time there, was an absolute dynamo of promoting New Testament research and promoting engagement with New Testament research done under the heading, if you like, of open historical critical method. And in that respect, that meant he had to engage with Protestant scholarship. Protestant scholarship in this period in the New Testament field had in a way run a long course under the influence of the historical critical method going back into the 18th century. And all of the drama of David Strauss and F.C. Bauer and others in the 19th century had taken them a long way. And added to that, in the 19th century, both in continental research and in British research, critical editions of early Christian documents began to be seriously, significantly produced around the place. And that that affected the way in which New Testament was studied, and it affected the way in which patristics was pursued. Anton Wörtler was a great advocate for the historical critical method, and he had numbers of students and contributed greatly. Rudolf Schneckenberg is also a very important contributor to this. He's more well known in English circles because, for reasons which I don't understand, more of his work was translated into English than was the case of Anton Wörtler, or indeed much more the case than Otto Kuss, who spent a lot of time in Munich. Otto Kuss was probably the most prodigious of these New Testament scholars. He wrote many essays. He wrote an extraordinary encyclopedic commentary on Romans, which ran to three volumes. And he had a lot of PhD students. Well, that's that side of the Roman Catholic research work, and I was a young New Testament lecturer in a university at that time, and we were really extraordinarily surprised and gratified by the reemergence of Catholic scholarship into the full circle of New Testament scholarship. But there is another group which also illustrates this great growth, and that is the formation in 1957 of a group of German-speaking, or German at first, German Catholic New Testament scholars. It's the conference. This conference started in 1957, not many people there, about 19. It was a very happy occasion. They got together. You can imagine this is a post-war period of Reconstruction. The Federal Republic had just been started, and this involved people not only from Germany, but from Austria. And as a consequence, they changed the name of the thing to the German-speaking Conference of New Testament Scholars, Catholic Scholars, Catholic New Testament Scholars. The meetings took place every 2 years after 1957, and its subjects give you some indication of the concerns of these people. I've given a list of those meetings and the topics they discussed in the appendix. It was a remarkable initiative. The first meeting of the society was exploratory, with only 19 present, and some general discussion. The following meetings revealed a focus on the use of the historical critical method in the study of the New Testament. Redaction criticism in 1959, redaction criticism being the task of critically examining the text and wording and structure, particularly of the Gospels, to try and discern what editorial tradition is reflected in each of them, then by a process of projection, just trying to identify what kind of community they arose in or were addressed to. That was the subject of their discussion. In 1961, Anton Werkler gave a paper on Rudolf Bultmann, on the Son of Man. The significance that is the question of Son of Man discussion in New Testament scholarship is, what are the antecedent material? What is the antecedent material for the use of this title, and what did it mean? And how did Jesus use this antecedent material, which you can identify in Daniel, or did he use some other backgrounds? The whole discussion was on the historical critical method Werkler's paper, for which over 50 people came. By this time, the conference attendees had come to include people from Austria, and they changed the name at that point. Given the prominent people involved in this conference, it would have been well known in the church, and particularly so amongst the German and Austrian bishops. 2 years after the start of this conference, in 1959, Pope John XXIII called for a council to be held in the Vatican. It was opened in 1964 and finished in December 65. The New Testament Scholars Conference was not only flourishing by the time of the council, but it embarked on a serious discussion of the historical critical method applied to the New Testament, a project that the Divino Afflante Spiritu encyclical had strongly encouraged with Catholic scholars. On October 2nd, 1964, Cardinal Franz Koenig of Vienna spoke to the council on behalf of the German-speaking bishops' conferences and declared that the Bible contains errors of science, history, and incorrectly attributed quotations. You all know, I guess, that this caused a significant debate on biblical inerrancy, which in turn led to the text that had been produced before the council being withdrawn at the behest of Pope Paul VI. And a new document came back, which eventually became Dei Verbum. My purpose here is not to pursue in detail the council's deliberations, totally beyond my competence, but rather to suggest that Dei Verbum is an important document and needs, I think, to be understood in relation to the kind of changes that were taking place, which Franz Koenig reported or reflected in a way at the council. The stream of Catholic theological work on the New Testament that was so enlarged by Divino Afflante Spiritu became part of the stream of which Vatican II became the main channel. The New Testament stuff was reflected in the growth of the publications of journals to which I've already alluded, and in a way, more importantly, the Conference of German-speaking New Testament Scholars that was formed in 57. That growth brought with it more engagements with Protestant scholars and with the development of the historical critical method that had been such a mark of Protestant scholarship since the early 18th century. Another aspect of this engagement can be found in the meeting of the Society in 1969 and 1971, when the topic was church office in the New Testament. This discussion ran over time, and at the first meeting, and the topic was set again for the second meeting. in between these meetings, the conference came to the notice of people in Rome, and not surprisingly. In 1991, the conference returned to the topic, and difference of opinion at the meeting was reported only for the second time in the record of the discussions. However, it was also reported that the meeting had agreed 4 points on this subject. The conclusions are both clear and provocative and imply significant theological issues for the legitimation of institutional traditions in the church. I've listed the four things that they agreed in the appendix, but I give you the two which I think are most relevant to this discussion. The New Testament does not yet speak of church office in the later sense of permanent and legal. The office appears more as a service function of the church. And point four, from a purely historical point of view, the New Testament shows a gap in the succession of the office of apostle, which does not allow a view of direct succession. However, it is not possible to exclude an actual context between the later office and the original apostolic office. The argument here is quite consonant with the institutional critique of the long 1960s. In this case, that critique was directed to certain elements, to central elements in the institutional self-understanding of the Roman Catholic Church. The point I wish to emphasize here is that the anti-institutionalism of the popular culture provided a cultural undergirding to the liberation of the German New Testament scholars in the long 1960s. Divino Afflante Spiritu encouraged intellectual openness in biblical studies, and that meant in the New Testament studies, the historical critical method. An early response to this method in relation to ecclesiology led to a quite fundamental critique of one of the foundations of the Catholic ecclesiastical form, as in that conference in 1971. Vatican II drew on a longer theological tradition of reform and in itself represents a more substantial voice. But the German New Testament research work that had been going on since 1947 fed into that reform movement. The biblical issue needed to engage the whole of the church's institutionality, and that meant that the impact of the mid-century dynamic of the historical critical method in New Testament studies was muted within this coherent whole of church institutionality. I have in mind here the kind of contrast which I will hope to draw between the response of the Roman Catholic Church and the Protestant churches. The great argument which is reflected in the conference which I referred to was to what extent would open-ended historical critical research on the New Testament documents lead to a significant challenge to some of the foundational institutions in the Roman Catholic ecclesiology. And the particular institutionality that's being attached here is the claim of the origins of those ecclesiastical traditions. Mid-century impact of the cultural disturbances and the triumph of the historical critical method was more a problem for those Protestants for whom the Bible and thus the canon was, if not the central defining institution for their identity. In this context, the scripture was thought to be the singular foundation of the church, and from the point of view of the institutionality of a Protestant church, any question about the canon is potentially of vital significance, given the determinative role of scripture in any ecclesial question. The question is more acute for any form of sola scriptura. The contrast I'm drawing here is that the more broad-based institutionality of the Roman Catholic ecclesiology, of which scripture is part and is, as Divino Afflante Spiritu and the other encyclical, keep in an institutional context which is very strongly entrenched. And therefore, the capacity of what the German Catholic New Testament scholars were doing and that the cultural movements could do had to engage with the church as a particular voice in a much wider and more substantially coherent institutionality. How the Roman Catholic Church has responded to this impulse is, of course, a story for another time. But I contrast it with what happened in the Protestants. What happened in the Protestant Church was that the New Testament historical critical method brought to sharp focus on the most vital part of the so-called Protestant ecclesiology, namely the canon of Scripture, and brought more questions to bear, therefore, on Protestant ecclesiology in a way in which Protestant churches were less able to defend their institutionality. But that's a story for another time. I think what I've tried to do is to say there was a huge impulse in the middle of the 20th century that affected the Catholic Church and the Protestant churches differently, and that's largely because of the history and strength and character of the institutionality of the two traditions. I think I'll stop there.
Thanks very much, Bruce. That's a combination of intellectual force and urbanity, which is a great privilege to hear. Any questions? But perhaps I could start by saying, asking you this. To what extent do you attribute the German movements to the work of Ranke in the previous century? Since secular historians will always speak about his enormous influence, but it seems to me that he was lurking in the wings of what you were saying. Or is that wrong?
No, I don't know. That's interesting. I hadn't really thought about that.
Because he laid great, the great tradition of scholarship, scriptural scholarship, comes with examining the sources, and that's the defining characteristic of the best modern historical scholarship too. And I'd always assumed that that came from his insistence, his Germanic insistence on seeking the sources.
Yes. I mean, I think generally in European historiography that's true, but how far it specifically affected the Catholic work, I'm not so sure about. I don't know.
Okay.
Others present may know, I don't.
Well, that's an interesting point because... what you said in some ways reflected or laid emphasis on the importance of politics in this, the division of Germany into a Protestant and the DDR, the so-called Democratic Republic, and the Bundesrepublic, was indeed, as I hadn't realized, it was only in retrospect that I realized that I'd been living and working in Munich in a very Catholic city. That was obvious, but in a city which was the Catholic part of Germany. It was very, very, very important realization from my time of working in Germany over many years. You'd have had a different experience, yes, in Freiburg.
I think I don't know how to explain this, but what I said was, I think, true at the time of the war, at the end of the war, but it didn't remain overwhelmingly Catholic. I presume that's because of immigration for the next 30 years.
Well, there's immigration from the West, from the East rather, but I can remember, struck by this point when I was working in Munich, I looked very hard, and the oldest Evangelische Kirche of the Lutheran Church that I could find in Munich was dated from the 1890s. And that tells us something, I think, about the very, and the South, all the Catholic part of Germany is to the South, and part of the Bundesrepublic up there in Nordrhein-Westfalen and beyond, up in Hamburg and so on, was Protestant. But it's still a country in which the Catholic part is in the South, I think. And I wondered to what extent that might have affected scholarship.
You mean Catholic scholarship?
Well, in particular, yes.
Yes.
And it would have been influenced by the migration, of course.
Yes. I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that.
Mm. Anyway, there must be other people with questions to ask.
I'm really interested to hear some Catholic voices correct what I've said.
Yes, Moira.
Right. These are just impressions, but I did come across quite a few people of different nationalities who were doing scripture theses, and Luther was very much in Catholic minds, but they felt that we had been too quick to condemn everything about Luther and that we should look again at some of his ideas. That's one point. The other thing is, I think that a great number of the German books that were translated into English had an impact because of their optimism, their positive presentation of biblical scholarship or the Bible, so that it was a very great difference from, for example, the homilies we used to get in the 1940s, which in my mind were mainly "thou shalt not," or "this is this and this and this and this are mortal sins." And I think the positive aspects of the New Testament and the positive aspects of Jesus' teaching were what made the impression in the German writings. That's just an impression. I haven't any proof of any of that.
Yes. I'm not sure how to respond to that. I think I remember hearing Hans Kuhn give a lecture in Basel, in which he asserted, he was speaking there on Reformation Day, that there were more Catholics doing research on Luther than there were Protestants.
Yes, I would believe that.
Yeah. Mm. He, of course, thought that was a great thing. I don't think in Europe Protestant scholars were doing more. I don't think they were so interested in Luther, and I don't think they were so much. Though it did come out in their New Testament work. I mean, if you track through the the history of the interpretation of Romans, that was the great Luther Protestant text, because it was regarded as the kind of great exposition of the doctrine of justification. And Lutheran interpretation of Romans in the period from the last quarter of the 18th century into the end of the, well into the first quarter of the 20th century, were concerned to maintain that tradition of Lutheran interpretation. In the middle of the 20th century, that line of interpretation in Protestant circles ran into a lot of difficulty. And in New Testament circles in the Anglo-Saxon or English-speaking world, the so-called new look on Paul really goes back to the dominance of the Lutheran interpretation in Protestant New Testament research in Germany of Romans, and the great revolutionary, in a way, on that point was Albert Schweitzer, curiously, in his two-volume work on Paul.
Alan Hogan?
I didn't have my hand up.
Oh, okay.
But I was just thinking on that our Catholic idea of what Luther said has been changed radically, I think, by people like Brendan Byrne.
Right.
Well, what Moira said had political and sociological dimensions to it. I mean, if I were going to make a flippant comment, I'd say that it's far easier to be optimistic when you're sitting having a beer in the summer in a Munich beer garden than it would be in Leipzig. And we were very influenced here by the dark, morose Irish temperament, so-called, at the same time as a temperament which had been moulded for about 400 years of British occupation. So people who were refugees from all that were not going to treat us in very optimistic ways. And yet a new country like Australia should have been seeking new ways of doing things. So I wonder to what extent it's a social thing as well as a political thing. But and the other thing we don't understand, and I don't know what you think about this, Bruce, having studied in rationalist Basel in Switzerland, right down there near France, the Germans place German acculturation, whether it's in through Lieder or folk stories like the Grimm brothers and so on, lays great emphasis on the German soul, die deutsche Seele, and Luther was very concerned about that. And so there's an element of taking everything very seriously, and that goes to study as well. So just wonder whether, from your position and perspective in Basel, you might have anything to say about that. Because we've never taken scholarship so seriously, but the English tradition, I think we've never taken scholarship nearly so seriously, whether it's in music or science or anything else, as the Germans have.
Well, I went to Basel in 67, and it's a German-speaking university, as you know. I would have to say I was in shock for the first 6 months at the level of what seemed to me to be unbelievably encyclopedic knowledge that these guys had. It was nothing like what I'd been brought up on. And when I did history and Greek and philosophy at Sydney University, and I had some wonderful teachers there. But the Germans, speaking Swiss, and quite a number of the professors were German, had a kind of power about them and knowledge that I was just overwhelmed by, I think. It was an extraordinary experience. So they really took it seriously. It was very, very significant. And I went back to England and taught in a university in Durham. The tone was lighter, undoubtedly, but the scholarship was it was very profound and linguistically sophisticated. I used to go to the staff seminar, and Durham was chaired by Kingsley C.K. Barrett, and it was held in the seminar room of the faculty, and round in the shelves were all of the contemporary literature in the critical editions, and no one ever thought of looking at any translation of any of them. Kingsley would just turn around and pick up a piece of Akkadian text and read it to us, and that again was overwhelming. But I felt quite out of my depth.
That reflected my experience when I first went to work in Munich too, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
Not that the Germans were trying to overwhelm us, but there was a depth of scholarship which I don't think we really understood. Anyway.
I'm interested in the place of the way in which the New Testament is handled. That's the historical critique, that's what I've been talking about. And the way in which we think about the church and its structures. My reading on this subject in the middle of the 20th century has led me to think that the Catholic institutional tradition, and I understand that it's a kind of, it's not what outsiders think it is, or whatever, I don't know, somehow has a coherence that the Protestant ecclesiology doesn't have, and that it's more able to respond and absorb things like revived historical critical New Testament research in Germany after the war than is an ecclesiology in Protestantism.
Helen Scanlon, you've got a hand up.
Sorry? I, for example, if you think about the rise of fundamentalism in Protestant Christianity, it's easy to get away with it. All you need is a bit of cultural background or support. But, I'm struggling with the ecclesiology issue, the institutionality of the ecclesiology in relationship to the way in which we do New Testament studies. See, in the New Testament Guild in the Protestant tradition is moving away from looking simply at the canonical literature, not by way of reference, but by way of focused study about the nature of Christianity. So that's I don't think I see that as very likely to happen in Catholic New Testament research.
Helen Scanlon, your hand's up.
I think the success of Vatican II was very much responsible, was the German theology that was being studied with the German scriptural studies was very influential on the whole thinking of Vatican II and the way that the attitudes there to the church and to church teaching and to scripture was so totally changed by the German work that had been done by the German scholars and the people in Europe. That was my comment only. And I noticed Jim's got his hand up too.
Bruce, could you give some sense of what the work you're talking about contrasts with? I mean, everybody's rude about the Catholic scholarship of, say, just before Divino Afflante Spiritu. What was that actually like?
Well, I didn't have a lot of contact with it as a student, but there was terrific work done in what one might call a sub-New Testament period. And I suspect that was tactically a kind of issue for Catholic scholars. But it all changed in the 50s and 60s and 70s. I mean, a guy like Wickenhauser, for example, writes really freely in way in which he's describing the literature he's doing. And Kuss is an unbelievably smart guy and well-read and learned. And he kind of plows on. He may finish up. He's a bit conservative in some ways, but I mean, he's rigorous about the way in which he approaches the text in what I would call historical critical ways. I'm not sure whether that's answering your question, Jim. I'm not sure that I'm...
Oh, that's okay.
Brian Lucas, your hand's up, but now you're unmuted, yes.
Thanks very much, Jack. And Bruce, if I could just perhaps focus on that question you raised about the coherence, as it were, of what you call the Catholic ecclesiology against the Protestant ecclesiology.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of a conversation we had once when I was secretary in Sydney, financial administrator. We used to meet across at St. Andrew's House, and there were 12 churches represented in this group. And I remember once a very, you know, vigorous conversation on this question of church polity and structure. So up at the at the hierarchical end, people were saying, well, you know, the people want more involvement, more participation. And down at what I might call the congregationalist end, the comment was, but I wish we had a bishop who could actually make a decision, because things have been, you know, at the standing committee for months and they're deadlocked. And I wonder whether that the pragmatic consequence of that approach informs the way in which then the scriptures are read. So if we take as a given that the New Testament is ambiguously silent about the precise level of structure, there comes a certain point, you know, where do we move from the 12 to the apostles, to the disciples, to the elders, to the presbyterate, to the deacons and so on. There comes a certain point of ambiguity, which is why we've now got all this research and discussion about women deacons. But there comes a point where, as it were, somebody has to make the decision. There has to be some point of historical coherence so that there is a structure within which the community can find its identity. And I think if you get too extreme to the congregationalist end, you've got this rampant individualism where the scriptures say whatever you want them to say. That's where you perhaps lose that coherence that you're speaking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand that point. I was the General Secretary of the Anglican Church, and we had decision-making challenges, not because lay people wanted to, you know, it wasn't the kind of congregationalist challenge. The challenge was that the institution was not quite strong or robust enough to put aside the political differences which with which the institutional structures had become infected. And so it was very hard for the Anglicans to make a decision. I remember one case, some poor archbishop moved something in our standing committee executive wanting some general change of some kind, and it went to the standing committee, and the standing committee sent it to the general synod, and the general synod said, this is a good idea, sent it back to the standing committee, and it finished up back again on the executive committee, executive of the standing committee. And I thought, this is a total waste of time. It's because the institutions were there, but they were paralyzed in some areas. And I think, frankly, it's killing our church. There you go.
And Tammy, you've got your hand up.
Yes, thank you, John. And thank you so much, Bruce. I found that really, really interesting. And what particularly sort of struck me was this whole notion of that German flourishing, the New Testament studies and investigation, and the possible factors that led to that, whether it, you know, obviously stemming from the war, and I mean, there are a whole range of things that perhaps you could attribute to that, but that's not my question. My question is relating to, you made a brief mention about the use of oral history sources, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about that. John talked about the Rankean antecedents a little bit earlier, where, you know, you're sort of studying the hard copy sources, and oral history is a little bit different to that. Could you maybe just shed a little bit more light on what you meant by that in terms of the New Testament scholarship?
I'm not sure that I quite understand the question from my paper. I mean, oral traditions became an important part of redaction critical studies of the New Testament, and that was basically in the late 60s, I guess, second half of the 60s. Yeah. And that was really quite influenced in New Testament, in the Guild, by Scandinavian countries, a number of key Scandinavian New Testament scholars who argued about the oral tradition and the failure of New Testament scholarship to take account of the fact that these were oral societies, and the way in which memory worked in oral societies was different from the way in which they worked in a literary society like Germany or England or whatever. But I think that tradition of the oral period, if I can put it that way, dissipated in the 70s, the early 70s in New Testament scholarship, was overtaken by a revival of literary studies and of contemporary social studies. In the 1970s, in the 60s and 70s, a number of background disciplines were being used by New Testament scholars: literary studies, Bible as literature, historical critical stuff in terms of long-term documents like in the redaction criticism model, the continued Bultmann use of just studying little bits and pieces of this was the residue of the oral studies. But in the 70s, people became more interested in and used more what one might call contemporary reference points. So as the rise of ancient social history in the 1970s became a really important factor, and still actually is a very powerful factor in New Testament studies. I'm impressed. I heard a sermon recently from a young clergyman who talked about the shame and fame culture in which Christianity was formed. Well, the shame and fame culture is a way of describing the Greco-Roman world, the Roman world particularly, in the late Republic and early Empire. And it's only become part of Roman social history since the early 70s. But it is now kind of percolated down to the parish pulpit as being the way in which to understand it. I mean, so the oral thing has been one of a number of ways in which you try to get at the question. And the question itself changed, I think, in the period we're talking about, the 70s, 80s, 90s, that's later, from the relationship between the historical Jesus and the Christ of faith, which was the big question in the 60s and 70s, and in which the oral issue had a role. The question, I think, now is more about not so much Jesus studies, but Pauline studies and the nature of Christian faith conceived of as a kind of doctrinal theological system or set of beliefs, and the way in which they are expressed in terms of moral character. I think so. Those questions have changed in a way. The questions have changed. The questions you ask undoubtedly have some influence on the method you use.
Thank you.
And that's a very profound question you raise, and it made me think again as I was thinking, as Bruce was speaking, that we live through historical movements, and we don't really understand what's. Who was it? Kierkegaard said, "Life is lived forwards and understood backwards." And it's only when you get someone like Bruce who's making you think that what was really happening there in the 60s. But as you say, it was happening in Germany in the 30s as well. This suppression of individuality in the name of the great leader and the Führer and the centralized activity. So I wonder whether Bruce thinks that played a part in bringing Germany to the fore, that they had an experience of it, which we in the rest of Europe and the European diaspora didn't really have. And whether you think that affected the way they think it, because what you're saying is a reminder that this individualistic tradition, which you said is an inheritance of the 60s, is still with us.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think individualism and whatever it is, communitarianism, whatever you call it, these are always with us one way or another. And what the 60s represented was a move down one end of that spectrum. And you, in a way, you can't get away from either of them, in a sense. I mean, otherwise you finish up in Russia or America.
Mm. Do you think that the present COVID era will be a comparable turning point and a recognition that we're more of a community, no man is an island, complete unto itself, and that we're more of a community and less of a group of individuals? Exactly. And if so, will there be a scholarly and intellectual response to that?
I wish I was as smart as you think I am by asking me such a question. I don't know. I mean, I think there's nothing brings people together than being attacked. And that's, in a sense, what's happened with COVID.
Yes, I suppose.
But once the enemy is withdrawn, who knows?
Well, I'm conscious of the fact that, like the bell tolling and John Donne, the clock is ticking. There are no more hands up. If that indicates that we've run. I hope it doesn't indicate we've run out of things to think about in what Bruce told us, because I found it incredibly thought-provoking. But I just want, on your behalf and the behalf of the Society, to thank him very much indeed for the extraordinary scholarship and infusion of rigour that he's brought to our proceedings. Thank you very much indeed, Bruce, on everyone's behalf.
Can I thank you in return for inviting me to your Catholic Society, and I'm really conscious that I'm an outsider and therefore may well be just blundering around in the place, but I've appreciated it very much. Thank you for the privilege.
We're all outsiders in a sense. Thank you, and thank you all for attending.
We've been listening to a podcast of the Australian Catholic Historical Society's second monthly meeting by Zoom, held on the 17th of October 2021. Anglican New Testament scholar Dr. Bruce Kay addressed the topic Catholic New Testament Research and the Significance of the Encyclical Divino Afflante Spiritu and Vatican II. Dr. Kay is Adjunct Research Professor at the Centre for Public and Contextual Theology, Charles Sturt University. He was formerly Master New College at the University of New South Wales. Dr. Kay was introduced, and subsequent discussion was moderated by the Society's president, Dr. John Carmody. Next month, also by Zoom, Dr. Oren O'Brien from Perth, Western Australia, and Dr. Colin Barr from the University of Aberdeen in the United Kingdom talk about Catholic archives and ask, are they history? That November meeting, a week earlier than usual, will be on Sunday, 14 November at 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight Saving Time. We hope that you can be with us for that meeting. This podcast was produced for the Society by me, John Kenny. Until next time, stay safe.